Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Charles Soubie's second novel, A Shot of Malaria, focuses on a San Francisco street musician who copes with addiction, mental illness, and dreams of recovery. This follows the author's debut, Winifred, and an unconventional love story. Kirkus's reviewer called Malaria a powerful, empathetic study of place and character with great depth. In this sponsored interview, we talk with Charles about his latest novel. Charles, welcome to Fully Booked.
Oh, thank you, Myra.
You were a San Francisco cab driver and street musician. How did you get interested in writing novels?
Well, I actually had been interested in writing all the way back to high school. I wrote a novel about about a folk singer who goes to Nashville to make it. Had to pick up guitar so that I would be authentic in the writing, and I ended up becoming the character in the novel for about 20 years.
How did your own experiences inform the main character of Malaria, Daniel Martin?
I am a musician, a guitarist, and a banjo player. I was a street musician in San Francisco, also in recovery from drug addiction. And so I've went through, you know, pretty dark period over a decade in the city.
In addition to writing, you perform and teach improv. How does this help you create your stories?
We call it an offer, an opening scene or opening moment of dialogue. And we believe there's no such thing as a bad first offer, that it's what comes after it. And that's been my experience, particularly with short stories, but also with the novel, just to write and not judge it.
You are a novelist, poet, and short story writer. Which form do you prefer?
Writing a novel is the most exciting. However, short stories are fun as well. But yeah, I like the thrill, you know, of having sort of like that headlight thing that's described where I can only see a certain amount ahead. Typically, I have a pretty good idea of where the book's going, you know, in the long run. But I love that idea of discovery.
What are your next projects?
Well, I've completed a third novel, The Wild Revisited. It's the story of a Ivy League grad who's supposed to go to work for his father as a mining lobbyist, but he has a lot of misgivings about that. Goes out to San Francisco to take a year off, and then decides to hitchhike up to the Yukon. And on his journey to the Yukon, it becomes a metaphor for, you know, the fork in the road for him, you know, where his life's going to go.
Charles, thanks for talking to us about your latest novel. If you're just joining the podcast, you can order Charles Soubie's A Shot of Malaria at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and independent bookstores.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
It felt really important for me to kind of create a space that you could look at these shows on their own merits and also place them in the cultural history.
I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to Fully Booked.
And I'm staff writer Megan LaBrice. Hi.
So this is our special Hollywood episode. Megan and I are in L.A. for the Los Angeles Times Book Festival. What's your favorite Hollywood book, Megan?
Yeah. If you're talking celebrity memoir, I mean, that's like kind of not my scene.
You don't.
None.
Yeah.
But I got to say that I was looking through some of our reviews earlier today, and there was one celebrity memoir that really did catch my eye, The Last Black Unicorn by Tiffany Haddish.
Yeah, and it's selling amazingly well. It's doing really well.
We starred it.
Yeah, we gave it a star.
Have you seen Girls Trip?
Yes.
I'm so glad.
She has such a wild story. I mean, that's a celebrity memoir you really should pay attention to.
Yeah, I'm not even going to talk about what I learned in our review on this podcast. I think everybody needs to go and read the review and then read the book, because I am en route to do that as soon as we're done recording.
It's worth the price of admission.
Oh, my
for
gosh.
Sure. But, you know, I mean, celebrity novels are a different thing. I mean, there are some interesting ones. Like, David Duchovny has been writing some interesting novels. And Lauren Graham of Gilmore Girls fame, who we're going to be talking about later in this episode.
And apparently Tom Hanks is quite confident at producing short stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That book got good reviews. And each of the stories, I think there's 17 stories in that book, features a typewriter in some way. He's one of those typewriter obsessed people.
He's always giving us new reasons to love him.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so today we're going to be talking to three really great writers. Joy Press is the first one of them, and she is the TV correspondent for Vanity Fair, has a really interesting new book called Stealing the Show, How Women Are Revolutionizing Television. And who are we going to talk to next, Megan?
The next person we are talking with is Adrienne Sharp. She is a novelist and also has published one story collection. Her latest novel is The Magnificent Esme Wells, and it's set in two times in two truly American cities. It's like 1930s Hollywood and late 40s, 50s-ish Las Vegas. So it's really, it's a story about ambition and mobsters and movie making, and it's, the heroine is truly unforgettable.
Yeah, and she does some fascinating research into the studio MGM in the 30s, so I love Hollywood history, so I'm excited to ask her about that. And also, I mean, her parents are really, or grandparents, I should say, are really some wild characters, so they factor into this novel. And then there's a talented reporter for the Wall Street Journal named Ben Fritz, who has a new book, The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies, which really is talking about why we get so many, what are called sort of franchise or global tentpole movies, these movies that just seem to never end, like the superhero movies that have all these offshoots and the Harry Potter franchise, for example.
I am one of those surly viewers who at this point has thrown up my hands, and I barely go to the movies anymore, which is a really sad thing because that used to be like one of my favorite things to do.
You're a streaming services person.
Yeah, I'm the kind of like, you know, sort of nerdy person that Amazon caters to. You know, the kind of like obscure, ephemera sort of, you know, like Mozart in the Jungle sort of watcher, you know.
That's okay. I think Ben Fritz would say that that's quite all right.
Well, we'll ask him.
Yeah, we're going to hold him to it. All right, so let's see what Joy has to say.
Joy Press has been thinking about TV for a long time. In the 2000s, she was the chief television critic at The Village Voice, and now she's the TV correspondent at Vanity Fair. We're talking to her today about her new book, Stealing the Show, How Women Are Revolutionizing Television. Welcome, Joy.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So in introducing this book, you write that this idea began percolating for you in 2015. Why was that? What was going on in television then?
Around 2015, there was kind of a felt like a shift in television. There had been a handful of shows in the years previous to that created by women that were sort of female-centric. You started seeing shows like Girls and New Girl. And I mean, there had been a handful of, you know, great Shonda Rhimes shows that had really kind of captured the public's imagination. But around 2015, it felt like there was a tipping point and that something was really happening in terms of women kind of having their voices and their visions kind of being realized on television. And part of it was, I think, there was a fracturing in terms of the network system. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of kind of cable channels and streaming sites, and there was just a lot more room for kind of women to sneak in there.
Yeah, and become showrunners. And before we go any further, I'd like if you would please define what that means for our listeners.
Yeah, the showrunner, the term is a relatively recent term. Traditionally, you had executive producers who were kind of the business people, and then you had the TV writers. You know, in the last kind of couple of decades, it's become – everything's been folded into one job, the person who's really responsible for the vision of the show. So it ends up being often the person who created it, the person who's sort of overseeing the writer's room, sometimes writing a lot of it, hiring the cast and, you know, responsible for helping, you know, hire the crew and then liaising with the network. So it's a crazy huge job. And it's usually writers. So writers are often not necessarily, you know, the people who are great at business, who are great at being tactful. And so it takes a special skill set to actually be a really good showrunner.
Writers aren't tactful? What are you saying?
Yeah, I don't know.
You heard it here first.
Maybe you've met different writers than I have.
I think we just broke some news. And so tell us about a few of the shows that you do cover in the book, because you have a nice sort of historical span here.
Yeah, I mean, I decided to start with kind of the late 80s. I start with Murphy Brown and Roseanne. Both of those shows, coincidentally, are, you know, been rebooted. That wasn't the case when I started. So I guess, you know, I was looking into the future. But, you know, I decided to start then because it was a moment when there was a very polarized political culture, and these shows kind of focused on very disruptive women, kind of entered the public conversation in a way that really hadn't ever happened before and almost hasn't happened since. They were really, really important in terms of, you know, defining what was happening in America. And so I followed that through, and I look at some showrunners who created kind of very female-centric shows from, I mean, we've got Amy Sherman Palladino's Gilmore Girls. We've got Shonda Rhimes and her slate of shows, you know, Tina Fey, 30 Rock. And then, you know, going through to, you know, people like Lena Dunham's Girls and Jenji Kohan, who created both Weeds and Orange is the New Black. Jill Soloway's Transparent is there at the end. So, and a handful of other shows in between.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the beginning of the book, and this is one of those, there's a lot of great little fascinating behind-the-scene tidbits in this book, but one of them is that I was sort of really intrigued to learn that at least part of the reason that Murphy Brown was such a sort of gruff character on screen, and, you know, it's worth remembering that in the early 90s that we hadn't really seen a woman be quite that unapologetic on major network TV up to that point, and part of the reason that her character was that way had to do with the time of the day that the show's creator, Diane English, finished the script for the pilot. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a crazy thing. Diane English had created this very strong female character who was a newscaster, her idea was, you know, she was going to be an older woman who had, you know, some wrangles. I think she, you know, had been banned from the White House. You know, she clearly caused a lot of trouble, and she was coming back from rehab. Mm-hmm. She had had, you know, problems with alcohol. And the network really loved the script and said, you know, could we make some changes? And one of them was, you know, they were very uncomfortable with this idea that, you know, she was that troubled. And they said maybe she could be coming back from a spa. And I think they also wanted, you know, they wanted the character to be younger.
Right.
And I know, you know, Diane English said, you know, Heather Locklear's name came up, you know, who was sort of a much younger kind of nubile, you know, actress. So obviously that would have been a very different show. But what happened was that there was a writer strike. And so the rules dictated that, you know, they couldn't change the script. I mean, normally you'd be able to make a lot of changes. And so the network was faced with a decision, which was take the pilot as is and get the show into production, or wait
until the strike was over
yeah. in order to make the changes. And right. so they decided to pull the trigger.
Yeah. But, you know, it's so intriguing because later in the book we learn that turning in a script late can be a very savvy strategy for getting past the censors or other people, the business executives who want to tone down sort of the edginess of a woman told story. Talk a little bit about how savvy writers have sort of manipulated the censors.
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly turning in script late seemed to be a strategy that Amy Sherman Palladino employed on Gilmore Girls. And, you know, I think that caused a certain amount of havoc. And I think that, you know, other showrunners have probably done that to pretty good effect, too.
Aaron Sorkin,
apparently. Yeah. I mean, I think it eliminates a certain level of pushback. The thing about television is it's a very collaborative medium. And, yeah. you know, when you talk about auteurs, it really does not exactly work in television because there are usually lots and lots of layers. I mean, first there's a writer's room. So you have multiple people who are kind of usually crafting a script, and a strong showrunner, a strong, you know, chief writer will kind of smooth some of that out. And I think Amy Sherman Palladino very much kind of imposed her voice on the show. And that's one of the reasons it's so wonderful is that you really feel this voice coming through. But sometimes that means really pushing back on the many levels of executives from the studio and the network who have opinions. And sometimes those opinions are probably great and shape the show. But if you have a really strong vision for your show, you're going to end up being in combat to a certain extent. Yeah. And actually that causes problems, you know, throughout my book. I talked to showrunners who really had problems with executives finding the idea of a woman pushing back very troublesome.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a big difference they find between the way that a male showrunner or a male auteur, is allowed to sort of take ownership and push back and be strong about, you know, protecting their vision. And, you know, when it comes to a female showrunner doing that, it's often considered to be difficult, problematic. It's you know, there's a big gap between the reception of those genders.
It's really interesting in discussing Diane English. I think part of, you know, what helped make her success was the fact that she didn't know the rules to play by necessarily.
Well, Diane English was pretty experienced by the time she got to Murphy Brown, although she came in through a side door. She had worked at PBS and funnily enough, she really got her first break by I think she was asked to give notes on an Ursula Le Guin screenplay. And maybe not even asked to give notes, you know, but she did give notes and they loved them. And she ended up being very involved in, you know, winning prizes for this PBS literary movie. Mm-hmm. And then she moved into doing lots of kind of movies of the week, and she worked her way up doing a couple of other sitcoms. So she was relatively experienced within the system, and I think she was very well respected, and that was part of why she was given leeway. I mean, she wrote a really flawless pilot script for Murphy Brown. If you think about how little was done to that, and if you watch the pilot, it's pretty amazing. It's all right there. You know, whereas somebody like Roseanne was really – had no sense of what the rules were and didn't care. And that created a lot of chaos.
I really liked your interviewing of her. You know, you gave us some really juicy tidbits about her early life and how she came to comedy that I was surprised and delighted to learn. I was wondering, though, in writing Stealing the Show, was it important for you to draw – it's about both the shows these women created and their lives. Was it important to you to draw that distinction between the two?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important to draw the distinction, because often women are assumed to be their characters. I mean, it's true of writers, and it's true of writers of writers of books and writers of television. And one of the things that was so interesting to me all the way through was that so many of these showrunners and writers who create problematic characters, wild characters, troubled characters, are very, very disciplined in real life. I mean, I talked about that with Broad City. You know, Broad City is very much a sort of cartoon fantasy version of the creators. And they work incredibly hard and they're incredibly disciplined in order to, I think one of them says, like, to create a space to play, you know. And so they have these, you know, stoned, you know, fun-loving characters who just wander the city and get into these amazing adventures and create this, like, liberating space. And yet, you know, they are working all the time. They are the showrunners. They took control of the show. They were originally given a showrunner. And they said, no, we know this vision better than anyone. And so, you know, the same thing for somebody like Tina Fey, and frankly, the same thing for somebody like Lena Dunham, who, you know, is completely confused with her character, and they definitely share some characteristics. But, you know, there's no way that Lena Dunham would have made a movie herself, would have gotten a show on the air, if she had been as feckless and self-destructive and as her character Hannah Horvath on Girls. And so you really do have to draw a line between those two, and also look at why they're conflated so much in the public eye. It's, I think, kind of problematic.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, you know, the ostensible sort of mission, I guess, of this book, which is sort of analyzing how women have transformed TV, but also this sort of effort you seem to be making to just document sexism. And one episode, and there are many in the book, but one of them is that when Amy Schumer's TV show, Inside Amy, debuted on Comedy Central in 2013, it became the network's most watched debut of that year. And yet Comedy Central's president, Ken Alterman, told Vanity Fair at the time that Schumer, quote, kind of transcends gender, ironically, because a lot of her stuff is about gender, but it's never alienating. So that idea that women, being women on TV could be alienating, comments like that pop up all throughout this book. And so I wondered, you know, did you feel a sort of mission to document that kind of sexism for readers who don't know how Hollywood and how TV really works behind the scenes?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing I wanted to do was tell a really good story. Right. I mean, I wanted the book to be a really fun read. And I felt there's a way in which television history is you know, defined by the teller, and that women have really been sidelined in the telling of that. You know, yeah. There's a canon of kind of the, you know, the new golden age of television, and women are often on the sidelines. So it felt really important for me to kind of create a space that you could look at these shows on their own merits and also place them in the cultural history. Yeah. And by doing that, there was no way that the sort of that that sexism, those problematic attitudes were not going to come through. So I tried to let them speak for themselves, and I certainly didn't go looking for them, but they're very apparent and they're everywhere. And frankly, I mean, one of the things that's most obvious when you actually start looking at television history is how much women are considered a niche. Mm. Right. So, you know, mainstream television,
half of the population niche.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, and it's true, you know, I mean, right. African-Americans are a niche. I mean, it's a crazy thing. You think about sort of the white male as default. And from demographic standpoint, younger white men were kind of the default. So the network system was trying to go for this broad mainstream audience. And the feeling was that women, you know, were a niche, and if you had a show that didn't have enough men, that was alienating, that was problematic. I mean, I think Liz Merriweather, who, you know, created New Girl, said, like, you know, the secret, according to network television, the secret is, you know, you have to have enough men. You have to have a lot of men in there. It's not a direct quote. You know, for New Girl, I mean, that was one of the important things for the network was you have to – I mean, it's called New Girl, but it's – majority male, you know, most of the, and right. They kind of kept making sure that there were enough guys in the cast to make sure that men would watch it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a very strange thing as you follow through because there are so many invisible strains of sexism, misogyny, you know, unconscious bias. And I finished this book before the Me Too conversation exploded. Yeah. And so for me, it's really interesting because all of that stuff was very veiled and was not anything that anyone would talk about. And if they'd even thought about it, they were certainly not going to openly discuss some of the, you know, kind of more brazen experiences that they'd had. So it is an interesting thing, but it's woven, it's embedded in Hollywood and certainly embedded in the television history.
Yeah.
So TV today, is it dealing with Me Too in any bold way yet that you've seen?
It's almost certainly going to percolate through TV. And you know, I think if you look back, certainly because there have been so many female creators and female writers who are rising to the surface, these issues are already kind of starting to be woven into, you know, even before Me Too. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the very last season of Girls, you know, there was an extraordinary episode in which, you know, the main character encounters an undermining male writer. And it's a really kind of nuanced and uncomfortable encounter with sort of misogyny and some of the problems that follow. So I think, you know, it's already there and it's yet to be seen. You know, I kind of hope we're not going to see a whole lot of like very special episodes.
Uh-huh. Well, this is a very special episode, but otherwise, no. Okay.
But I do think that Hollywood is trying to figure out how to deal with it. And, you know, I think that the more women there are in power, I mean, certainly we've seen in television, we've seen some disgraced men step away and some women take their place. I think there are certainly more and more, you know, women and people of color kind of moving into positions of power, on the, you know, on the executive side. And then you have more and more, women moving into the kind of writing and producing space and directing space. So hopefully that will continue.
Well, you said that you hoped you wrote an entertaining book. It is really entertaining. It is titled Stealing the Show, How Women Are Revolutionizing Television. And Joy, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you guys so much.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books right here on Fully Booked.
Podcast fans, listen up. Barbara Boxer is back in the political ring with her podcast, Fight Back with Barbara Boxer, every Thursday on Podcast One. She's tackling today's hottest issues alongside her daughter, Nicole, and featuring notable guests such as Senator Dianne Feinstein and many more. Download Fight Back with Barbara Boxer at Podcast One and Apple Podcasts. Also remember to rate and review.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
Adrian Sharp is the author of The Magnificent Esme Wells, a dazzling historical fiction set in the glittering heydays of two American cities, 1930s Los Angeles and late 40s Las Vegas. This lushly imagined, fun-to-read, noirish tragedy, as our reviewer writes in a starred review, stars a clear-eyed 20-year-old narrator with the beauty, talent, wit, and poise she needs to achieve fame and fortune, despite danger, disappointment, and loss. Welcome, Adrian.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Would you please introduce our listeners to Esme?
Esme is an interesting combination of my mother and my uncle. I gave my mom's characteristics, her beauty, her magnetism, and her smarts to my uncle, who had the unfortunate life of living with the grandparents, my grandparents, my mom's parents, who left her behind in Baltimore in an orphanage in order to go west to play the horses and bet at the racetracks. And they had a second child in L.A., my uncle, who, like Esme in the novel, never got to go to school, ate hot dogs for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and pretty much had to make her own way in the world. Now, my uncle ended up escaping those parents by joining the army, and then, being practically illiterate, had trouble finding a job and was actually working as a janitor. My mom got to stay behind and got an education, ended up working at NIH and marrying and having the kind of stable life she always wanted. So I put together these two characters, my mom in my uncle's body, living in 1939 Los Angeles, kind of imagining the adventures my grandparents had and giving them to Esme.
So, and are your mom and uncle still with us?
They are.
And so you've explained this transmogrification of bodies to them?
My uncle hasn't read the book.
Okay.
My mom has, and she's sufficiently disguised to be comfortable with her new incarnation.
Okay.
And I think she hadn't considered so much what my uncle's life was like out here in Los Angeles. But I have a picture of my grandfather and my uncle. I don't know how I got it, walking a downtown Los Angeles street. He couldn't be more than mid-30s, but he looks almost 50. I think this life wore him down.
Yeah.
The constant struggle for the next bet, the next win, lots of apartment evictions and being moved here and there.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure they probably went to Las Vegas, where I ended up taking the family in my novel.
Right, right. So I want to ask you about sort of historical research, because I think one reason we gave The Magnificent Esme Wells a starred review is because we felt like your research into MGM in the 1930s and certainly Las Vegas in the late 40s is just really well done. So could you just tell us a little bit about that research and how, also how you knew when to stop researching? Because those realms, you know, the studio system and Las Vegas as it was really being born, there's so much great stuff there. So how did you know when to stop?
I think that's the greatest problem with writing a historical novel, is to not stuff it full of every fact that you possibly know. And so after you're writing, then you go back and eliminate. For example, I had an opening scene with Esme as a kid stepping onto the Flamingo grounds for the first time, and I originally had all kinds of information in there about the red light district and the auctioning off of land and the blocks of ice that they used to cool underneath the tents. And my daughter read a draft and said, "Mom, I just think there's a lot of stuff in here, like those blocks of ice." And my husband from the next room calls out, "Hey, I told you to take those blocks of ice out of there." So I think that's the kind of thing you go through. You read and read, and one source leads to another until you've got so much material and you want to share it. And then you have to pull out the stuff that's not going to add to your particular character's story.
Yeah, and that can be tough.
You really focus on two beautiful places that, to me, as your reader, were incredibly well lit. There's kind of a lot of, there's a glow, there's an illumination that comes through in your portrayal of both Los Angeles and Las Vegas. Is that something you were aware of?
I love both those cities.
Yeah.
Even though I think the most beautiful parts of Los Angeles are the most expensive parts of Los Angeles.
Right.
So a lot of people don't get to live and enjoy in those places. But Las Vegas is cheap. It was open to everyone. And what interested me about it was sort of a second Jewish empire, which I hadn't really known. I thought Italian-American mobsters built Las Vegas. Not really true. It was the Jewish mobsters who built Las Vegas. And so that was interesting to me. I found it hilarious that Jack Entratter, who ran the showgirls at one of the casinos, was the president of the temple that they established in Vegas, and that all these men had not just built casinos, but then wanted to be empire builders and built neighborhoods and office buildings and condos and shopping malls and hospitals. They really created another city, a parallel city to beautiful Los Angeles.
Yeah.
We first meet Esme with her father. He's a young Jewish man. He has tremendous aspirations, and they've come from Los Angeles to check out Las Vegas at the behest of whom?
Ben Siegel. My character got involved with some of the Los Angeles Jewish mobsters, Mickey Cohen and Ben Siegel among them. After Ben Siegel's murder, Mickey Cohen took over a lot of Ben's operations.
We're talking about Bugsy Siegel.
Bugsy Siegel.
Also known as.
Yes, the nickname he hated.
Right.
And I have my character call him Benny because he's almost a father figure to her. And she only realizes much later that he was sort of grooming her the way a pedophile does to eventually be one of his lovers. Grooming her with treats and lipstick and high-heeled shoes and allowing her to be a cigarette girl and be on the casino floor even though she's too young, and then allowing her to be one of the early flamingo dancers. So they have a sort of what she thinks is he's a second father to her and doesn't recognize what her own father recognizes. And after Ben's murder, another mobster steps in to take his place, and that's my fictional Nate Stein.
So you used to be a ballerina, and so much of this novel is about performance and the power that performers have over other people. So obviously, you know, autobiographical question here, that made me wonder how much you feel your life as a performer influenced Esme's character.
I think a lot. Originally, I had the mom becoming the dancer in Las Vegas in an earlier draft, and Esme following along. Then I realized Esme can't be an observer all the time, and it also is more interesting to see this young girl navigate this male-dominated world and try to figure out how to gain power for herself. And the only means she has is her beauty. Mm-hmm. And so she's going to use that to create money for herself. Mm-hmm. And so it's her idea to use Nate Stein's interest in her to give her a platform at the Desert Inn so she can perform there. And then it's her moxie to ask for a cut of the tables. And he, like all the other men who are reinventing themselves there, enjoys her energy and grants her what she wants.
Early on in her childhood, her father tells her, you know, don't be anyone's puppet, be the one pulling the strings. And he's speaking from a place where he believes that he is such a string puller, but as we travel through the book, we see that she is really the one, the self-possessed one in that family.
And at the end of the novel, she realizes she's been more of a puppet than she knows.
But we still, our reviewer still said that the phrase was that this novel has a, quote, subtle feminist trajectory. Is that, you're obviously purposefully weaving that in. Is that fair to say?
I think so. Partly inspired by my mom moving in a man's world. She was a pre-med student in the 50s at a time when women were not pre-med. And one of her fellow students came over to her and said, stop throwing the curve off with your high grades. You're just here to get your MRS degree, but we're all going to med school.
Ay, ay, ay.
And in fact, she got an offer to go to med school, and the pediatrician she worked for offered to put her through and then make her a partner in his practice. But this was the 50s, and she chose another path, you know, the MRS path, right? But right. So for my character, that wasn't really an option for her. Mm-hmm. So she needed to find the way that women get power, and the way women got power in Las Vegas in the 50s was through their bodies and their faces.
Well, for me, she's all about voice. I could listen to her narrate 10 more books.
Thank you. I think the trick of every character is finding that voice. My previous novel, The True Memoirs of Little Kay, was about a ballerina who had been the mistress of the Tsar. And I had trouble with her voice until I found the line, I've always admired an opportunist being one myself. And that gave me the door open. And I think Esme is the same way. She is an opportunist and she's scrappy. And she's looking in the first part of the book to hold her family together and hold its fortunes together and keep her parents happy. And in the second part of the book, now she's looking to protect her father and to help him find his way as she finds her own way in this new dangerous world.
Yeah. So I just wonder, I mean, because your mother's parents do seem like sort of such colorful characters. I mean, obviously there's some real darkness there, but did you find out about their, did you know them well, I guess, growing up?
And never met them.
You never met them. Okay. And so you heard about them from your mother and your uncle, I'm guessing. And so it is such a sad story. I mean, them leaving your mother in an orphanage. How did she come to tell you about it? And how do you think that revelation, you know, played into this novel?
I didn't understand that people had two sets of grandparents until one day we watched our neighbor's family arrive. And my sister and I watched an elderly couple and then another elderly couple. And we said, who are those people? That's my dad's parents and that's my mom's parents. And my sister and I looked at each other. We only had one set of grandparents and a lot of aunts. So we went into my mom to ask her and she burst into tears. And this for my mom is something she has been deeply ashamed about. Even though we kids feel like, why are you ashamed? It's your parents who should be ashamed. But it was always embarrassing for her to have to say that she had guardians instead of parents. And to have to explain to people in Jewish Baltimore, who the first question is always, who are your parents? Well, I don't really have these parents. And even at their 50th wedding anniversary party, which we kids threw them, she was worried about having their wedding pictures out because someone might see that she didn't have parents there and might ask a question. And we're like, Mom, everyone's 75. No one is asking who your parents are anymore. So it's been this shadow story that's shaped our family and our relationships and behavior with our mom. And she always wanted her story told, but I couldn't tell that story exactly. I grew up out here. I came out here when I was 19. I don't know Baltimore. I don't know that world, but I do know this world. And I couldn't end it the way she wanted to, with the woman in the suburbs and then finding her parents and making sure they were buried properly, even after what they had done to her, because I just didn't know that story. But what I could do is take the landscape my mother never walked through and the parents I never met and recreate them in some way from her stories and put my mom into them.
It's a beautiful thing about fiction. You can take a story you partly know and imagine the rest of it. So you grew up here. Do you have a favorite L.A. novel or Hollywood novel?
That's a hard question.
There are some great ones.
I adore Day of the Locust. I just think it captures so well the hodgepodge beauty of the crazy way this city was built and the influx of different kinds of people to come to LA and to be the extras and to try to be stars and the desperation, anxiety of those hangers-on and the dangerous adoration of moviegoers and movie fans. I think that would have to be my favorite one.
Yeah, yeah. Nice. Well, we love this novel about L.A. It's The Magnificent Esme Wells. The writer is Adrian Sharp. And thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
In Nelson Cover's thriller, From the Midst of Wickedness, an associate professor gets tangled up in a scandal involving a university president, a multi-million-dollar campus project, and some sketchy donations, putting him into some very dangerous territory. Kirkus's review called it, quote, a slow-burning thriller that reveals the seedy politics of higher learning in America, end quote. In this sponsored interview, we'll talk with Cover about it and what inspired him to write it. Nelson Cover, welcome to Fully Booked.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So your novel takes place in the world of academia, and I was wondering, what is your personal experience in that world, and what caused you to make it the setting of your novel?
Well, for 43 years, I was a professional fundraiser, the last 30 as founder and president of my own company. We had a number of university clients as well. That's where I start, as well as the fact that that's where I started my career.
I see.
So there's a lot of background involved.
So is there any particular mystery or thriller writers that have inspired you over the years?
Not particularly. What inspired me here was a lot of personal experience in different client settings that I felt were really important to get out. You know, there's a campus novel and tradition in this country. And most of it is through academia, either from the professor or student standpoint.
Uh-huh.
I felt there was a lot more to be said from an administration standpoint, and I had a lot of experience in that. So I wanted to write a book focused on those topics.
Right. So the fundraising aspect you saw just not ever being covered in these campus novels you
wanted
to. Exactly. Right.
Exactly. Well, it's a dirty word.
Right. So in 2013, you self-published a novel, Dance by the Light of the Moon, about a dangerous sailing trip, and it sounds like a very different kind of thriller. And I was just wondering, how did your approach to this new book differ?
From the standpoint of the first one is a sailing adventure with a bunch of 30-somethings who get themselves naively into a very bad situation in the British Virgin Islands. From the Midst of Wickedness is a far deeper book about really people that have no values. Values are only their own selfish motivation. What that means when you have a president, for instance, who doesn't draw the line between what is morally right or ethical and what his it will take to fulfill his ambitions, and how that might link up with sources of funding, particularly possibly clandestine. Just a whole nother paradigm of experience. The first was through a hobby, sailing. The second, through professional association over decades with nonprofit organizations.
Thank you, Nelson. Listeners can find Nelson Cover's novel, From the Midst of Wickedness, at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores. Nelson, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Ben Fritz is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal who writes about Hollywood. His new book, The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies, answers a question we have been wondering about for a while now. Why does Hollywood make so many superhero movies and not so many movies that take risk? Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you for having me.
So it seems easy to blame the sort of corporate overlords of the studios for making movies less interesting. And according to your book, that actually is too easy. We should also blame ourselves because you write that moviegoers are actually more interested in franchise movies like Harry Potter or superhero movies than we are in movie stars who may be pursuing a passion project that becomes a really artful movie. But the reasons you write about why we seem less interested in movie stars are really interesting. Can you sort of talk about them?
Sure. I mean, there's a few factors in that. I mean, a key one, of course, is the rise of television, the golden age of TV and streaming. I mean, a big reason people used to go to the movies was because TV was, as we called it, the idiot box, right? And the reason TV was an idiot box was because it was advertiser supported. So advertisers want to reach the biggest audience possible. They didn't really care if you like it. They just cared that you watch it.
Right.
So that means the lowest common denominator programming. And that's what we would get on, you know, the big three or four networks, right? Now TV is largely subscription based, right? You pay your $10 or $15 a month for Netflix or HBO or your $100 a year for Amazon and your cable bill, whatever it is. So they care about passion. You want to feel like you're getting your money's worth out of it so you don't cancel. So they'd rather have 2 million people who love a show than 10 million people who are like, eh, it's okay. There's nothing better to watch. So that's given rise to all this great, diverse, original, risk-taking, fascinating programming that we see. So, and you don't need to go to the movies for that. And who wants to get off their butt, leave their living room, take a risk spending 10, 15, 20 bucks a ticket for a movie that might be good, right? The marginal cost of watching something new on Netflix is zero, right? If it's not good, what did you lose? Just a little bit of time. Movie theater, it's a lot of money, you know, comparatively. So when we want to go to the movies now, we tend to want to go to something that we know what we're going to get. Yeah. And you know what you're going to get. If you go to see a branded film, a Jurassic World, a Marvel, a Harry Potter, you kind of know what you're going to get. Right? Yeah. So you need your money's worth. And that's true for Americans, and that's true even more so in these developing markets where moviegoing is a new habit, you know, in China and Russia. And of course, there, we can get into that, they're a bigger and bigger part of the movie business now.
But you also mentioned briefly that the sort of constant paparazzi coverage of movie stars makes them, I'm guessing, a little less alluring to us. Mm-hmm.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, we know it's hard for Tom Cruise to sink into a role, right? We know so much about Tom Cruise's personal life. Just for example, and I think I mentioned in the book, you know, he's had a particular problem appealing to women within his roles because I think a lot of women know a lot about his personal life and maybe don't care for it so much, some of his choices, right? And that's been a problem for studios that cast him. And so that's why some movie stars, really big stars like him, don't fit well with these brands, right? Like Tom Cruise for a while was actually considered for the role of Iron Man. And one reason, you know, Marvel, when they eventually made that film, didn't go with him was they thought he's bigger than the character. And in these branded cinematic universes, Marvel being the perfect example, they never want a movie star that's bigger than the character. They want the characters that are bigger than the stars so that the talent never has too much power.
Right.
Are you familiar with the criticism of Charles Taylor?
Not very well, no.
Oh, he had an interesting book come out recently. I think it was opening Wednesday at a drive-in theater.
You know what? Yeah. My agent sent me that book. I haven't read it yet, though.
I would recommend it to you. And it's kind of about 70s shadow cinema. And in that, he also writes about kind of like the infantilization of the American audience, how there had used to be like these grimy, second, weird, strange, plot-driven, you know, outre pieces that were available to us, and now they've pretty much been culled, you know, completely from availability.
That's right. I mean, that's certainly true in movie theaters, right? It's very, you know, it's very rare to see a film that takes a real risk, that is really original, that isn't something that can at least potentially make hundreds of millions of dollars in success. The films kind of things you're talking about don't. In fairness, like, you know, it costs significant amounts of money to make even in the inexpensive films, you know? And when you look at their track record, it's not good and it's getting worse. So, but, you know, something I do argue in the book, especially near the end, is that, yes, we are losing something for sure by having less and less of that kind of film in the theater. But, you know, we're getting such a broader array of content on our televisions and digital devices, and not just TV shows anymore. I mean, you look at, you know, the original movies or miniseries being made on Netflix, for example. There's so many of them, and some of them are certainly quite risk-taking and interesting, in fact, I would argue. And same thing is true on Amazon and Hulu and HBO. And some of them even start to blur the lines. You know, you have an 8-hour TV season now. It's no longer 22 episodes, or you have a 3 or 4-part miniseries. And so it can be, it's no longer, you know, 22-hour-long episodes or a movie. There's all this stuff in the middle, and it's kind of becoming a continuum, I would say. It's a spectrum of visual content. And in that scenario, whether or not you label it a film or a TV show kind of becomes less important. I think we are getting a lot of interesting, original, risk-taking visual content. It's just disappearing from the cinema.
So it's hard to talk about this book without talking about this sort of infamous hack. Of course, we think North Korea did.
Yes.
Of Sony's emails. And of course, they've released many other kinds of materials. You know, on the one hand, I mean, you're using those that sort of treasure trove of information is a real, you know, source and sort of basis for this book. So it's a reporter's dream in that sense, like so many insights that you can uncover. But I just am curious, as a reporter, I mean, having that degree of access is also kind of a liability, isn't it? Because the people who were sort of cruelly exposed and didn't expect to be exposed know that you know the info, but they may not want to talk to you because the info was gotten deceptively.
Yes. Well, that's somewhat true. Look, there are some people who are not happy that I wrote this book, right? And you can imagine there are some of the people who are most prominently featured in the book, and I don't blame them.
Right.
You know, I wouldn't be thrilled if somebody got all my emails and decided to write a book about journalism and used me as a, you know, key character.
Right.
That wouldn't be fun. You know, there's the ethical question, and then there's the how it impacted my reporting. Ethically, I feel like it's any other leaked material, and, you know, lots of leaked material has been used in journalism over the years, and this stuff was already out there, and I feel like I hopefully use it for, you know, the purposes of an illuminating business book, and I was very careful not to use anything that was about people's personal lives. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say is, to your question, I have to say, as a reporter, honestly, having that leak material was helpful. It really was, even to get interviews, because I would be able to say to people, look, I have this material. I am writing this book. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this material doesn't cover everything. So if you want to help fill in the holes and make the story more complete, which will probably be useful for you, you really should talk to me.
Right.
You know, if otherwise it'll be an incomplete picture, and most people didn't want that incomplete picture. And I got a lot of people who currently or formerly worked at Sony Pictures to speak to me for the book, mostly anonymously, but they were incredibly helpful. And in writing it, I completely blurred the lines for the reader as to what stuff is from the hack, what stuff is from interviews, and what stuff is from materials that some people who worked there shared with me separate from the hack.
Well, of course, you know, the number one name on my lips is Amy Pascal. What's her career been like since that hack?
And just remind us, what was her title and her role before the...
Amy Pascal, her title was co-chairman of Sony Pictures. In practice, that meant she led their motion picture group. She was the person who decided what movies they made, how they marketed them. You know, we're talking $1 billion a year of spending on movie production and probably another $1 billion of movie marketing every year. So she had a lot of power, you know, and she in particular, more than some other studios, her tastes, her personality really defined what the movie Sony made. And that's for a long time, more than a decade. So soon after the hack, she was fired. You know, ostensibly it was for performance, and Sony's movie business had not been doing well for a few years. But I think anybody close to that studio would say that, you know, there was the hack that ultimately did her in. You know, there was stuff that came out in that hack that was embarrassing, including some racially offensive jokes and just things about the way she did her business and the hole that Sony was in and how she was struggling to get out of it, that just really kind of made it impossible for her to do her job. She was fired, and she got a pretty lucrative production deal at the studio, and she's become a film producer since then, based at Sony. So some of her movies are made there, and she has an office on the lot, a gorgeous office on the lot, I should say, in what used to be the schoolhouse for the kids who worked at MGM back in the day. She, you know, she's been nominated for Best Picture. She produced The Post. She also produced
The movie with Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks.
Yeah, the Steven Spielberg film about the Pentagon Papers. Yeah. She produced that. She's also producing the new Spider-Man movies that Sony's making in partnership with Marvel. So she's doing both kind of, you know, big tentpole movies and more original dramas, which I think is more where her heart is. And she's trying to make the kind of movies that the studios can't make anymore, that she couldn't make at Sony. You know, she's trying to sort of keep that flame alive. And, you know, there's a line in the book about how she was really always intended to be a producer, and I think running a studio was ultimately a bad fit for her.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because she was so successful at producing, and that success is what got her to be at this very sort of lofty position at Sony. But she was, I guess, administrating so much that she wasn't able to sort of do her passion, which was producing.
Right. Yeah, she wasn't really able to get as hands-on in the films as she wanted. That's really what she wanted to do. And it was a problem with the studio. It was the woman in charge of everything was getting involved, very detailed in script development and casting and that kind of thing. That's what she loved to do. Yeah. But meanwhile, the corporate strategy was flailing. You know, it wasn't well focused, especially as, you know, the book's about the transition to this franchise age of filmmaking. And Sony did not make that transition very well, and in large part because Amy was not well suited for the franchise age of filmmaking.
You know, we're in this moment where big Hollywood films aren't really these sort of mid-budget dramas that you were talking about. There are these franchise films that are really made for a global audience. Do you see that trend remaining that way? Do you think we're going to go back to some iteration of Hollywood that we knew before, where sort of interesting dramas were made?
I see that trend largely remaining for what the traditional studios make and what we get in theaters. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to think those economic factors would fundamentally change. You know, the DVD market is still gone, and I don't see that coming back, okay? It's still a very global audience, and for the foreseeable future, that, you know, when you're trying to make something that can appeal to people simultaneously in Shanghai and Moscow and Rio and the United States, again, these big branded, lowest common denominator entertainment makes sense. What I do see changing is the more and more that these digital players like Netflix and Amazon and soon Apple get into producing content, including films, and the more the traditional studios are partnering with them. You know, if AT&T ends up buying Warner Brothers, for example, mm-hmm. and as Disney gets into streaming and becomes a technology company, which they're doing, we're going to see just more and more this other kinds of content that's been lost in the traditional movie business getting made. Yeah. You know, it's a golden age for visual content, and I see more and more of it coming. But I think they're either not going to play in theaters, or they'll have kind of perfunctory theatrical releases that are just in the major cities for a short amount of time for people who really prefer theaters and want to go there, and to make sure it's, you know, eligible for the Oscars and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the theaters are not going to be the reason these movies get made the way it used to be.
It is such a tighter window for going to the theater than it used to be.
You know, absolutely.
Totally miss something very easily. But I mean, but I guess what, you know, I hear you saying is that, you know, the big studios aren't really making these sort of risk-taking films, but we shouldn't really be crying about it. I mean, they're somewhere else. They're existing. You just may have to look a little bit harder.
You have to look harder, and you have to be, if you were a cinema lover, willing to change your habits a bit, you know? And I do think if we were to go back 20 years ago and say, hey, imagine a future where a lot more great, original, risk-taking, compelling, auteur-driven content is being made. But the trade-off is you have to watch more of it at home. You can't watch as much of it in theaters. Is that a good trade-off? You know, I think a lot of us would say yes. You know, I'd rather the content get made than be like, well, less of it's made, but at least it's always in the place where I am used to seeing it.
Right.
Not to say nothing's lost. I do think things are lost by not having as many of those shared experiences of watching something in a theater together.
Yeah.
You know, something's definitely lost. It's a trade-off, and there's certainly something valuable on the other side of the scales.
Yeah.
And overall, how is this trend affecting the festival circuit? You know, South by Southwest, Telluride, you know, Sundance.
Well, you know, look at if Cannes, for example. There's a big controversy that they're not letting Netflix films in, mm-hmm. and that's because of the laws in France that you, if you play a film in a theater, you can't release it at home for a certain amount of time, and Netflix doesn't follow those rules. They only release films simultaneously. Yeah. So it's a real source of conflict. You know, the festival story in the U.S., the way they're adjusting is they're letting the streaming movies in, and actually many of them now have TV sections. They're becoming bigger and bigger because because the kinds of content people go to festivals to see, and now more and more of that stuff is TV shows or TV limited series. So you're seeing, you know, that there's a big TV section at Sundance, and it's becoming a bigger and bigger part of it.
Well, if you are curious about why we get the kind of Hollywood movies that we do, then Fritz's book is The Big Picture. It's really insightful, and thanks for stopping by.
Thank you so much.
All right, so that wraps up our Everything You Need to Know About Hollywood episode. We're going to go back to what we might politely call regular authors next week, who are not writing about Hollywood. And also thank you to the Los Angeles Times for hosting the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books. Megan and I were there all weekend, and we had a great time.
This was my first Festival of Books, and I've got to say, I don't know that I've ever experienced anything like it on that scale.
It's huge.
It's huge. Yeah. And I have to say, out of everything, like a true highlight for me, or in other parlance, I was living for this panel called To Die For, Scientific and Cultural Responses to Death. Because you know I'm a huge Caitlin Doughty fan. She's the author of From Here to Eternity. She joined us on an episode a few months back.
Yeah.
And to get to see her in person was a treat.
Well, also, I mean, she's just fascinating because she's carved out this niche in publishing writing about funeral rites and about death. She's a really interesting writer, I think. So.
Yeah. And of course, you recall my brief stint in the funeral industry.
I do recall that. That's pre-Kirkus days.
Yes.
Yeah. You fortunately have not brought any of the typical funerary personality to Kirkus Reviews.
No. Yeah. All personality, all the time.
That's right, right. So, all right, we hope you join us next week for the May 15th episode. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
New to Podcast One, The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Join Todd as he interviews the biggest names in Hollywood, like Adam Sandler.
We drove down there and my brother's like, do you have your material? I said, what do you mean?
Rebel Wilson.
I couldn't interact with these people, so I put on this American accent and pretended to be American.
And Isla Fisher.
I just wrote a passionate letter explaining how much I wanted to be a clown, begging them to accept me.
Download new episodes of The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, or Apple Podcasts.